Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe, where the mission is to normalize the conversation on sexuality while providing you with a real education on sex, intimacy, and relationships. You know, the one you never got in school, from your parents, friends, or the internet. I'm your host, Susan Morgan Taylor. Let's get down to it. Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Sex Talk Cafe. My guest today is Charna Castle. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist and a trauma-trained psychotherapist and embodied sexuality coach who helps clients heal and find bodily joy, vitality, emotional regulation, and hope. Over the past 30 years, Charna worked as a sex educator, then as a master somatic coach and body worker, and now as a licensed psychotherapist in private practice. In addition, she taught sexuality education, led body wisdom workshops, and offered trauma and resilience training in various institutions, nonprofits, and therapeutic settings. Charna is in private practice in Oakland, California, and you can learn more about Charna at passionatelife.org, and we'll also be sharing at the end of our conversation today a little bit more about how you can connect with Charna. Charna, welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, this is going to be an exciting conversation, and what I find super interesting about your journey just in reading your bio, you went from kind of the coaching and education world, bodywork world, into the psychotherapy world. And I have a kind of a similar path. I kind of started in coaching. I also did bodywork for many years, and then I went into the mental health psychotherapy path, although I've actually exited the psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. And you're, yeah, and so I think this is really cool, and I think we can have a really awesome conversation just around, I think there's a lot of questions sometimes out there as well with what you do in terms of the somatic the sex therapy versus somatic sex therapy, what the difference is. I know I get that question all the time, and I think it'd be really cool to dive into that. And also just kind of what the difference is between somatics versus sort of the traditional talk therapy route. So I know we're going to have a great conversation today. Mm-hmm. Before we do that, I would love for our listeners to hear a little bit from you, just a little bit about your journey and in mm-hmm. how you got to where you are today with your work.
So, you know, I had started talk therapy at 14 and done talk therapy for 10 years before discovering somatic therapy for myself. Mm-hmm. And it was a dramatic difference. I mean, not all somatic psychotherapy is the same, or somatic therapy is the same.
Right.
I happened to be working with a somatic coach, and she used martial arts-based practices and body work. And so we were in practices that helped, you know, when you're, for instance, if you're learning a dance routine, you put your body into something repeatedly, and you then can embody it, and then you learn something new mm-hmm. through repetition. And the mm-hmm. same idea, but take that and relate it to relationships, mm-hmm. right? So boundaries, rather than talking about the concept of boundaries, physically repeating something until you have an embodied boundary. So that work comes from the Strozzi Institute, from Richard Strozzi Heckler and Stacey Haynes, who created Generative Somatics. Before that, it was called Somatics and Trauma. And that was, so she was my first somatic coach. Then I followed her to the Strozzi Institute, where she was one of my teachers. And I followed her wherever she went and, you know, did trauma training with her, worked at Generation 5, or not worked at, trained with Generation 5, which is committed to ending child sexual abuse within five generations mm-hmm. and focused around social justice. So that was my entry point for somatic work.
Okay. Well, so let's clarify for listeners too. I'm sure you get, I get this question all the time too, and I know you do as well. Let's clarify for people who maybe don't really know, what does somatic even mean? What are we even talking about?
So somatic means the body, spirit, emotions interconnected, basically, right? Mm-hmm. So somatic work helps you become more conscious of how your beliefs, your thoughts, your emotions live in your body, how there's a connection there. Mm-hmm. So when I'm working with people, some somatic psychotherapists may just bring people's mindfulness and attention to that connection. Mm. I do use touch with my clients.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, because of my basis, I'm a very unconventional psychotherapist.
Yeah, awesome. Welcome to the club.
Yeah. So I'm really curious. I want to hear more about your exit from, because there have been a number of times over the years where I've questioned how valuable being a psychotherapist is. And it creates a lot of usefulness around your awareness of your patterns. Mm-hmm. And there's always the relationship between a psychotherapist and a client. It's a testing ground, right?
Yeah.
Creating safety, getting to be heard and listened to and reflected for the first time if you've grown up with a family of people where your emotions and needs were not allowed. So there's usefulness. The way that I talk about it is that my psychotherapeutic training, like if you were to look at a beautiful mosaic, psychotherapeutic training is the grout. And my somatic work is the tiles, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm much more compelled by the embodiment training that I received before I became a psychotherapist. But the 3,000 hours of sitting with clients is useful training for seeing yourself.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like the clients you attract, like what is, you know, what are you working out during that time? So it's useful. It's just, you know, it doesn't inspire me necessarily.
We gotta have coffee.
Go into
that whole conversation. But I think for people who are listening who maybe, you know, I think even with sex therapy, a lot of people don't even know that that's a thing, that sex therapists are even a thing in the mental health realm, which is really more of a mental health specialty, sex therapy. And then we have the somatic sex therapy realms, or the somatic psychotherapists, which is a slightly different approach. And so for people listening, maybe someone who's considering working with a professional in the realm of mental health and or somatics, like how would you describe the difference between, like, what would your sessions look like if you were working with someone in traditional sex therapy versus doing a somatic approach with a client?
Well, because I'm not trained as a traditional psychotherapist / sex therapist. I mean, look, there's if someone isn't a psychotherapist, there's something called, you know, sexological bodywork, which could be a hands-on, and it's legal. There's a hands-on approach. I'm always working fully clothed with my clients. If I want to teach a client, for instance, like about whole body orgasm, I'm describing and talking to them. I'm not doing any kind of hands-on work. I would refer someone out to learn how to do that. I actually, you know, did do a Tantra teacher training and sat with this thing of like, do I want to go down that route? Like, do I want to, you know, and there are people who are psychotherapists and then they have separate careers doing this other kind of work, which does involve hands-on, not clothed contact, but that's not what I do in my private practice. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that is a specific distinction. You know, how I'm working with clients, my somatics training, which again, like embodiment, in case you don't know what that is how do you feel and exist in your whole self, all parts of you? So what happens with trauma is there can be a disassociating or leaving and not occupying certain parts of the body. Like if you've been molested and feel like my chest is not a safe place to exist, and then you remove all your awareness and your sensation, and then you have numb breasts, for instance. Yeah. So, or just simply existing in a world where there's sexism and it's not safe, you could have a cervix that's really numb. Or you could have a cervix that's really painful. So trauma often, it lives in the tissue as either numbness or pain, chronic pain. Yeah.
Right.
And so helping to, there's someone who's not trained somatically may not have that same level of awareness or give certain kinds of homework, I'm assuming. I can't really speak to what a non-somatic oriented sex therapist would be.
I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I have one of my best friends is one. Actually, she runs the head of the she started the program at California Institute for Integral Studies where we met in grad school. But I really don't know the difference in the kinds of homework we give. You know, I also work with energy. So I'm trained in energy medicine as well. So I really kind of approach things from every angle.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about trauma. So I know somatic work is very useful with people who are experiencing challenges from some form of trauma. And I think that when people hear the word trauma, a lot of times they think, well, I don't have trauma because I wasn't sexually abused, or I haven't been in a, you know, some kind of major accident. These big T, what I call like big T trauma. And I think it'd be really interesting to kind of have a conversation around what exactly is trauma, at least how you define it. A, mm-hmm. what is trauma? What are we even talking about when we say that? And then maybe we can explore a little bit about the somatic approach of healing, somatic healing therapies, how they actually can help to resolve traumatic responses. But first, what is trauma? What are we even talking about?
So since this is a sex talk cafe podcast, let me tell you how I define sexual trauma. Like the difference between, conventionally, I think people think of sexual trauma as there's either sexual assault or child sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And I think of, you know, there's your sexual energy, and that's also your life force. So anything that squeezes down on your vitality, right? So you could grow up in a family where there's drug addiction, mm-hmm. Where there's physical abuse. You could grow up in a society where there's racism or homophobia. And so all the things that we need to do to be less visible, to be more safe, are more acceptable, right? You could grow up in a culture where fundamentalist, you know, Christianity, and there's so much shame around sexuality and sexual self-expression. So anytime you squeeze yourself in, I don't know if is this video?
Yes.
Okay. So if you're like squeezing in or squeezing down or trying to take up less space, mm-hmm. be more acceptable, mm-hmm. you're squeezing down on your life force and your ability to be fully expressed in all ways.
I love
that.
And so
how does that not affect, you know, whether you can ask for more pleasure, how you ask, what you like if you're so occupied, you know, preoccupied with safety.
Yeah, and I think that I love that description, because I think the way you just described that, I think we all can relate to that. Mm-hmm. And what I'll offer to that is, you know, I grew up in a family where I was not, like, anger was not okay. Like, don't be angry, be happy, you know, don't be upset, don't be sad. So what ended up happening was I completely mm-hmm. shut down my access to my anger, but also my access to my joy and pleasure. And when I went through my whole awakening in 2011 around my sexuality, what came up, A, was numbness. Actually, mm-hmm. I had a lot of numbness in my genitals, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And then massive amounts of just anger and deep grief that just poured from my out of my heart. It all just mm-hmm. came rushing out of my heart. And so all that release that I wasn't able to really feel and experience, you know, growing up, and then in my marriage and my relationship, I just couldn't, you know, it wasn't a safe place to express. I didn't know how. I didn't have the resource. I didn't know how. I was scared to feel angry. Mm-hmm. And it was so interesting because it did show up in the body as numbness. And then mm-hmm. when all of that emotion was released somatically through the body-based practices that I was engaged in at the time, a lot of sensitivity came back and full body orgasmic experiences. You know, I began to have access to those. And so mm-hmm. I think the way you describe that is so beautiful. And so I would love anyone listening to understand that I think what you're speaking to, Charna, is that, you know, we all have trauma, little, you know, what I would call little T trauma, like these just by being alive and being influenced by our surroundings, our culture, our family, our relationships, that these things over time, when we're shrinking down, again, it's not safe to be ourselves, not safe to feel, or I don't want to be perceived as a slut, so I'm going to pull my awareness out of my pelvic area, because if I'm too sexy, then I'm going to be perceived a certain way. And that shrinking down absolutely siphons off our life force. And I'm sure you probably agree, is really our sexual energy is our life force. That's how mm-hmm. I look at that. The libido is, you know, really means life force, which is a big popular term also in, you know, the history of psychotherapy. Not that I'm a huge fan of Sigmund Freud or anything. But, you know, he had some good stuff in there. And that whole idea of the libido is like that zest for life. And what you're speaking to is the sort of the contracting around it and the siphoning of it off is how you're defining trauma.
Right. And so traditional, you know, if we're just looking at take the somatic out of it and you look at what trauma is, there's different categories of trauma.
Okay. Right. Well, let's talk about that.
developmental trauma, so things that are happening repeatedly in your childhood development, right? So there's, when you look at CPTSD, that's like lots of different kinds of, so that's a chronic form of trauma that causes PTSD versus PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, that could happen from an incidental trauma.
Right. So you're referring to developmental trauma versus like some incidental trauma, like where there was a, you know, a sexual assault or a car accident versus developmental trauma, which happens more over the lifespan. So these are the what did you call it? CTPSD is the developmental.
If you just add a C in front of the PTSD. Chronic.
Chronic. Okay.
Yeah. So, depending on what you're dealing with, like if you're dealing with a singular incident, like, you know, 9/11, a home invasion, a singular incident, it's easier to move through the system. It's not as long term.
Okay.
When you're dealing with something that starts in utero or it starts at birth, or you're dealing with a daily form of abuse, that is more cellular and pre-verbal, perhaps, subconscious. It's like it's entrained in your system in a deeper way, so it takes a longer time to undo.
Yes, that totally makes sense. And I'm kind of curious, do you have any examples of clients you have worked with? And maybe could you just share what that process was like and what kind of, like, what did you find when they first started working with you? And what are some of the results and experiences that you witnessed as they began to move through some of that more chronic type of trauma through your approach? Like, I'd love to just like a real world example of this. I think it'd be great for our listeners.
Mm-hmm. This is an interesting situation. So sometimes, especially when something is pre-verbal, right? Like you don't have language to describe what's happening for you. And so one person, if you line people up, people love to compare their traumas and, you know, rank them, right? But if you take somebody who, if you look at their life and you go, oh, well, there wasn't physical abuse, there wasn't sexual abuse, they're really privileged in all these ways, but there's something there. And that could be somebody's dealing with something that's pre-verbal. They don't have language for their experience. I also attend to generational trauma. Mm-hmm. So what I'm holding in the space is sometimes people are playing stories out that don't even belong to them. It belongs to their parents, right? And I can give a separate example of that. But this one person I think is an interesting case. It's like there wasn't a lot of story that you could point to, but there was something in her. It was very interesting. She wanted the work to happen while she was asleep, basically. Like, she didn't really want to be an active participant in the healing, which was triggering for me as someone who's like, I don't want to be a victim. So it was really, there was a lot of learning for me as a young therapist working with her. And she wanted to do body work. But what I could appreciate over time was, like, there was some wise part of her that wanted this work to happen, that was, she didn't want to do this standing up martial arts based practices that built in relationship skills that would have her take charge in her life. She wanted to be laying down. Mm-hmm. And I do different kinds of trauma release body work. One of the things that she's working with is she really wanted to feel supported. Right. So laying down, her whole back and back body is being supported. First of all, I could put my hand on her body and she initially couldn't feel me. She initially couldn't feel my support and my presence. And so over time, her ability to take in the support that was available increased. Mm-hmm. Right. So eventually standing up, when she was willing to do standing practices, I would have her walk towards me, put her hand on my chest, which is a metaphor for asking for what you want. So it's like, can you actually take responsibility for getting the support that you need or asking for what you want? Mm. And initially she stood and she would extend her arm perfectly straight, which when you have a locked joint, it blocks the energy flow. Mm-hmm. So from one person to another. And then she would lean her body weight into me versus staying grounded over her own feet. So when two people are differentiated, when there's the ability to be like, we are interdependent, which means we are connected, but we can support ourselves versus that what was initially showing up in her system was, I want you to take full responsibility for me. I'm going to push you away physically with this arm. I feel like I'm being pushed away, but, and you're asking for something, but you're not actually receiving it. Right.
Wow.
So that's the
that's so
the metaphor. It's so, I love working this way. And so eventually it was like, oh, she could like center inside herself, not be so focused on the person over there.
Yeah.
And she could hold herself up. Like she had a lot of, there was a lot of like kind of flaccidity to her muscle tone. It's like actually being upright and connected. Right. So that's just, that's one example of working through body work, working through standing practices. And the idea is that through repetition, right, you can rewire the brain through the body. And when we initially do a physical exercise, it's just enough stress and newness that it evokes someone's belief system and what their habit is, what they practice in their life.
Ooh, like you can see, like they always talk about body language as being like saying more than words, right? I mean,
oh yeah,
that's a thing. And that's kind of what you're speaking to, is the body kind of reveals a lot more about our psychology and our personality and our history even, and our relational styles than if we just sit there and talk about it or fill out a questionnaire, for example.
Well, it's, you know, I'll do boundary exercises and somebody might say, oh yeah, I've got good boundaries.
Right.
And then when I do an exercise and I'm like, okay, tell me when I've gotten close enough, and they freeze. They actually can't say no or stop. Or it's very rigid. So when it's not an embodied boundary, you know, I'm asking someone to like set a boundary with me, it'll be very aggressive.
Yeah.
Right. So an embodied boundary allows you to have grace, allows you to say no a lot sooner. Often people will often be kind of like almost choked out or suffocated, but they're like, no, when I'm walking towards them and doing some kind of practice with them.
Yeah. Well, I think boundaries are such an interesting conversation as well. And I'd love to see your, because you just talked about a true boundary. And so one of the things that I understand with boundaries, we can have like a false boundary. And I think that's sort of what you're, there's a true boundary and a false boundary. And other examples of false boundaries might be like disassociating, for example, or falling asleep, right? Like sort of those trauma responses that we have, or survival responses. Which aren't really true boundaries. It's like a way to stay safe. But can you speak to that? Like sort of the difference between what you just referred to as a true boundary and maybe what like a false boundary might look like? And why is it so important to have the development of a true boundary?
Interesting. I haven't really heard that terminology, like a false versus a true boundary. But I can speak to, so dissociation is very useful. I actually encourage people to, I help people learn how to choicefully dissociate.
Oh, wow. Say more about that. So why? Why is it useful? Because usually you hear that's not a good thing, especially if you're working with trauma. And embodiment is sort of the opposite of dissociation. That's how I hear it anyway.
So the last thing that we need is more shame, right?
Okay.
And so people can feel shame for dissociating. And so dissociation, it's like, think about if you're in back pain, if you have back pain and you have to do a presentation, so useful. I got a tattoo at 25. I barely felt 40 hours of tattooing. How brilliant is that? How useful is that? So it can be useful at times. But what happens with dissociation is you can think of you're a little being who is overwhelmed, doesn't have enough resource to process the amount of the feelings that they're having. They don't have resources externally or internally to be with their experience. So they leave their body, or they tuck down in deep inside and go numb. And I can go into, if you want me to, I can go into all the ways that like you can tell if someone's dissociating. But so dissociation, the way that it functions, though, is whatever you've dissociated from and haven't been able to be with, that is often when you get triggered as an adult.
Yeah.
whatever you've dissociated from is what comes online. You feel in your body, you see in your visuals, right? There can be flashbacks or body memories. So different ways of experiencing the past, and it feels so real because it's waiting to be felt. It lays latent. And so it's very important to become conscious of what you've dissociated from so that it doesn't run the show under duress. Yeah. When you are stressed out, your perception of reality gets altered by whatever you've dissociated from. Because that is what you see laid over the person that you're in a fight with.
Right. And I think some of the challenge with somatic work and what you're speaking to is really this requirement to, I use the term embrace a lot in my work, right? It's greeting the thing that's there in a regulated and titrated way, I imagine, especially when there's really a lot of trauma. We don't want to move that too quickly. But sometimes there's this fear of feeling, right? Like, I don't obviously that was too much to feel at some point for this person. And then having to like actually move through the feeling in the body is really, really scary for many people. So I can imagine that could be a real, maybe a turnoff or a resistance for some people around this kind of work, the somatic work, where they're being asked to actually come into the body and come into these really uncomfortable places that they have disassociated from. Can you speak to that a little bit? And like, what's your take on that? And how would you work with that? Or what would you say to somebody maybe that's thinking about this approach, but is really afraid, because and sometimes afraid that they'll get stuck there, right? That I'm just going to be depressed the rest of my life. If I let myself feel those feelings, I'll get flooded and I'll just stay stuck there and it'll never go away.
It's extremely common. I don't think there's anyone, myself included, that I've met who doesn't have a fear of, like, you know, you express that anger was the thing that was unacceptable in your household. I also had to stuff a lot of rage, which then manifested in inflammatory chronic ailment things, you know? So the fear is, if I actually feel this feeling, whether it's pleasure sometimes for people, or turn on, whether it's rage, whether it's grief, or terror, that it'll consume, it'll completely destroy me, or it'll destroy the other person. And they've done studies that if you actually feel into this emotion, it usually lasts, it runs about 20 minutes, and then there's a sense of peace afterwards. And it's not like you felt all of the rage that you're ever going to feel, but what it does is, once you've moved through something, you've cycled through it, and you haven't been destroyed, and no one else has died. You go, oh, wait, it actually builds trust. It's like, oh, I know how this can work. And so then the next time it happens, if you also meditating is really useful, to develop an observer of like, oh, I'm going through this thing. A part of me is processing this emotional charge, and it's not going to be forever.
Right? Yeah.
And so it takes trust, and I think what you said is so important. So sometimes what I do with people is I'll literally set a timer for 1 minute. Can we be with this shame? Because shame is such a hard feeling, or powerlessness is such a hard feeling. Let's be with this for 1 minute. What's that like? Let's sit on the edge of it. Like, we don't have to go into it. Let's just be on the edge of it. And then, okay, that was a minute. Would it be okay to do it for another minute? So micro dosing. Yeah. Whatever the experience is, doing body work, like you mentioned titration, which is, in case people don't know what that is, there's feeling the really hard feeling, but there's also feeling the thing that feels really good or resourced in the body. And it might even just be a pinky toe. It might not be something, and it might be your dog, or it might be my dog who I use in the room. Like, feel Toshi, touch her fur. Like, what is that like for you? Can you feel her with you? Can you feel me with you? If a human's not safe, like, is there a place in nature? So recalling something that is really resourcing for someone and feels soothing in some way. But before I go into all those scary big feelings, what I'm first working with anyone is safety.
Yeah.
So I'm working with, like, what was the thing that you didn't get? And, you know, how could someone have been with you that would have felt safer or more supportive. Mm-hmm. And it might be that I'm all the way across the room from them and I'm not touching them. And I'm not looking at them. I'm not even facing them.
Right.
And I'm letting them know they get to be as, you know, like I'm not going to come towards them if they don't want me to. So I'm really giving them as much space and acceptance as they need to first establish any safety before they have to be with the vulnerability of anything more.
Right? Yeah, it's so powerful, that thought. And I think the curiosity that comes to my brain as I hear you say that is that can be extremely challenging for someone who has is not well resourced within themselves to do even that, even to ask for you to move across the room, or I don't know what I need to feel safe, because they have such a pattern of unsafety happening in the body. And it's just that sort of response, that chronic activation of the nervous system that's so, they're just used to that. That, so I imagine that, like, even getting to that point, there's probably a pre-process that happens.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I can speak to that for when I was training. That particular kind of an exercise like that, I was doing with a group of people. There were four of us in a group, and each person had to go through and ask for something. And I viscerally remember my experience, which was there was a part of me that wanted to sit in the lap of the guy, and another part of me that was like, fuck no, are you kidding me? Like, just was disgusted and resistant. And so I had everybody, I mean, there were enough people to support me in that. And that's why I love group work. One person was the part that wanted to surrender and be supported and have an experience that I'd never had, which is like really having that supportive father figure. Mm-hmm. And then another part that was like, there's no way. Mm. I'm not going to do that. So I got to have all those different parts of me supported. And that's that points to another way that I work, which is parts work, right?
Yeah, which, you know, because a lot of times I think, well, let's talk about that, because I think a lot of times we think that it's very normal to not understand that these opposing aspects of ourselves can coexist. Mm-hmm. You can both have desire for connection or support and also that avoidance of it, that sort of push-pull dynamic. And I think what you're speaking to is how we make space for both of those aspects of ourselves to be welcome and to really become sort of celebrated and also integrated in a sense. So maybe you can speak to that a little bit of like, why is that so important in healing work and in somatics?
Yeah. Well, because we have, so it's interesting, you know, internal family systems is a way of working with parts that's very popular right now. Mm-hmm. But before I ever knew anything about internal family systems, I really, just in doing trauma therapy work for myself, you have to work with these parts. Because if you think about being in a family or a culture where it's not safe to exist, you have to we all develop a team inside of us, and they manage us in different ways. Hmm. One might be the one who keeps you in line and, you know, keeps you as a perfectionist. One regulates your anger. One is a very young part of you that, you know, needs certain kind of contact. So if you're in a conversation with an external person, if they keep talking over you and don't listen to what you're saying, does that soothe you? Do you feel like, oh, okay, I got what I needed. I'm fine now. No, it usually ratchets up and escalates, and you're like yelling over one another. Yeah. Right? So internally, it's very useful to learn how to observe and turn towards each of these parts and understand that they are managing something. They're protecting you in a very distinct way that's specific to them. Like, here's this loyal soldier who is going to attend to you and not leave its post, but it never gets the memo that you've developed new skills or you're no longer in that household. So it's still doing what it learned how to do, what it was trained to do 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, which can be really unproductive potentially in the current setting.
Yes, and what I see is that the thing that someone usually comes to me for, that they're like, I want to eradicate this part of me. Oh. This part of me sucks. It's usually that we need to turn towards that part of them. Mm. Appreciate how that part of them has actually protected them and taken care of them in some way. And before someone can actually acknowledge and appreciate that, it doesn't change.
Yeah.
because they're stuck in that battle. They're dug in.
Right. Right. Like trying to get rid of this thing, which is part of them. It has some purpose, right? There's some purpose to that aspect of themselves. And if they're in denial, or we're in denial of that, we're sort of in resistance, in a battle with it, instead of, can we find and like dance with it? Like you mentioned, Aikido is a form of martial arts. And I think of, you know, Aikido is the martial art where you flow with. It's so cool.
Yes.
And it's similar, I think, to what you're speaking to here with those parts of ourselves that we want to eradicate. Can we meet it and move with it and use the energy of it actually to feed and to generate something maybe even positive from that aspect?
Right. In Aikido, you're receiving and you're potentially redirecting.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so, you know, when I, just to come back to that example, like if I'm doing an exercise with someone and we're doing a boundary, let's say you're walking towards me, both of our hands are up like this, and this is a very, very clear boundary that you would have with someone on the street, right? Mm-hmm. Someone, it's like, no. So they come in, you receive them, and you send them back and you separate, you take space versus staying connected. Some boundaries you stay connected. And that's very confusing for a lot of people, which is a whole separate conversation. But what happens is when someone actually just blocks, when they just strong arm, straighten their arms and push their hands out and say, no, I don't go anywhere. The boundary doesn't happen. They're just blocking the energy. Yeah. It's almost like the energy hits the wall and slides down it versus if they're able to receive my force coming into them and move, take it in and then redirect it, they're moving me with my force, with my energy, right?
Well, boundaries, though, I love that. I love how you describe that. And that's really cool. And I've always thought of, you know, I've done a lot of energy. I used to actually be an energy worker as well, or that was like the main way that I worked with clients in the world. And I worked with one of my mentors, and when we would work with energetic boundaries as an energy thing, I took this from her and I use this, and I love it speaks to what you're speaking to, that boundaries can be more like a gummy bear instead of like a brick wall. So there's sort of that softness to them where they can receive impact, so to speak, but they don't crack or break. Like, you know, if something hit a wall really hard, it might crack the wall, or right? And so I think that's very similar to what you're speaking to, is that there's sort of this ability to be impacted and influenced, but without the, you know, potential brittleness, or even, you know, too soft of a boundary would allow for violation, versus too brittle of a boundary might crack or break, or the energy just stops. It doesn't have a sort of a mutual co-creation that can happen from that interaction.
Yeah. So one of the practices that I teach clients, so before we do a physical exercise, I have them center in themselves and call all of their energy back to them, right? Create a semi-permeable boundary around them.
Right.
So it's like, think of like a fishnet.
Yeah.
Right. It can allow in what feels nourishing, and it allows out what no longer serves them or doesn't belong to them.
Yeah. Right? I like that fishnet.
So there's that kind of like semi-permeable boundary. And then once we're physically doing an exercise, some people, you know, if the pendulum has been like no boundaries, then they might need to start with rigid boundaries and give themselves permission. Like, I get to say no and don't have to explain myself.
Yeah. Isn't that nice? It's so freeing.
It can be very confusing for the other person, but it's like, I don't have to justify. And so then as you develop more embodied boundaries, I consider it's like, oh, you're actually developing compassionate boundaries, right? Again, that you can say no and have it be soft and trust that it's still going to be heard and be respected, which is really hard initially for people to get.
Sure.
Like, unless I punch you in the face and karate chop you, like you're not going to hear my boundary.
Well, and I think what you just said, the word compassion, how I look at compassion really ultimately is about the boundary of the self-love. And boundaries really begin with the love of ourself enough to set a boundary, to not allow the violation to happen. And that's a whole process in and of itself, much less the relational space, right? When we go horizontal, I would say like the horizontal direction where it's relational between, let's say, you and I, having that good vertical alignment with our boundaries, that I can love myself enough to allow myself to say no, for example, And this other piece that I can say no and not have to justify it. I mean, you know, how many of us have really had that opportunity in life? We're constantly challenged. Why do you want that? Why don't you want to do that? Don't you want, I mean, you should want to do it. Well, you wanted to do it last week. Why don't you want to do it this week? And I don't understand why you don't, you know, like we're constantly just, that's sort of the way that we, habitually tend to interact until, unless we have some awareness, you know, certainly some of us are just sort of naturally aware, but we're not really taught this kind of stuff, generally speaking. So there's a lot to be said on this compassion part, the self-love, mm-hmm. and then how loving it actually is to another person for us to honor that, and for the other person to honor that just with a thank you, for example. Thank you for taking care of yourself. Thank you for setting a boundary. Instead of what so many of us have had in the past, where we're just sort of trained to violate ourselves, I feel like.
Well, and it's also what I love when I'm doing boundary work with clients is they'll often be surprised by how good it feels when I, like, when I say no to them, And it's just calm, centered, and clear. They're relieved to have that kind of clarity on the other side.
Absolutely.
Sometimes there's, like, you know, there's all this rejection and all the stuff that comes up. But, you know, you can't respect somebody else's boundaries if you don't have your own boundaries, right?
So true.
It's very confusing if your boundaries have been violated, which, if, you know, during child sexual abuse, no gets taken away. The option to say no gets taken away. And so then you become an adult who doesn't understand other people's boundaries or need for boundaries, or even what a boundary is.
What it even is. Yeah.
Right? I've worked with a number of adult men who they haven't had the experience of getting to say no either. Mm. Right? Like, teaching a man in his 60s how to say no is so profound.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about today, or anything that you want to clarify that we have talked about that you'd like to leave our listeners with before we wrap up?
I think the thing that you were saying about no as a self-love practice, you know, sometimes that, like, self-love can be, there's cycles that, like, you move through, you know, like you land in a level of self-love, and it's just like you have to keep revisiting it because there's layers to remove, to move through, to get back to yourself. And all of this work is about, you know, self-compassion. I feel like being self-responsive, being able to know what feels good, what doesn't feel good, which comes through embodiment, ultimately that the byproduct was compassion, self-compassion for me. It wasn't like a goal. It wasn't something I could go towards. It was like, you know, now it's here. But that process of accepting all parts of ourselves, even the parts that don't feel pretty, you know, are is such an important process so that we can actually have that much more compassion for other people.
Yeah.
And that I really believe in 125% a somatic approach versus, like, we aren't not just a head. We're not just a bunch of thoughts, right? Like, it doesn't, to me, make sense to not be addressing the whole self.
I agree, and I don't think you can really, I mean, you really can't separate the mind and the body. The body is the subconscious mind. And I think what is also so interesting is, you know, the modern realm of psychotherapy is so, it's very far from how it began, because it actually began in somatics. It began in the body with altered states and hypnosis and accessing traumas in the body and releasing through catharsis. And so it's so interesting to me how far it has veered from really what it was intended to be, and how much fear there tends to be, generally speaking, in the mental health domain around the body and around touch. Mm-hmm. We tend to think touch is so over-sexualized in our Western culture, or at least in America. You know, we hear the word touch and we immediately think sex. And so many of us aren't getting that need for healthy touch met, and we don't have a reference point for what that even looks like without it being sexualized. So I think the somatic approach, I believe, is really truly the future of healing, and really the future of mental health, because the mind is the body is the mind and the mind is the body. So I don't even know what we mean when we say mental health. We've turned it from, it's turned into just neck up and let's analyze it and think about it and talk, which just puts us in our prefrontal cortex. We're in the beta brain waves, which is totally opposite of where our shit lives, right?
Exactly.
In the emotional and in the body and the subconscious. Yeah, so I just think that it's so interesting how I hope that revolution is, I think it is happening.
Oh, yeah.
And there's people like yourself and myself who are really kind of building that bridge and sort of doing things that are maybe a little outside the box, but really building that bridge between those realms so that it can be integrated and that we can really truly be healed rather than kind of stuck in therapy for 20 years, you know, like.
Well, and that's, you
who has
know,
the time and resources for that? Something's not working. If you're in therapy after 20 years, still, for most people, something is not working, okay?
Well, so 25 years ago, I was working with Stacey Haynes, my somatic therapist, and we were talking about this, right? We were talking about how somatic work, you can get, it's basically like in 2 years, you can do what it takes 20 years to do in talk therapy.
Right. You may never get to it in 20 years of talk therapy.
Well, and so a very important distinction, I think, is that if for some people talk therapy is great, right? But if you're working with the nervous system, if you know, that attending to the nervous system, that's where somatic therapy, I think, is really essential.
Yeah, when it comes to trauma and even just resolving sort of more unconscious relational patterns and... Yeah, I mean, my vote is really for somatics. Talk therapy, it does have a place. I don't mean to completely bash it. It has a place, but it reaches its limit at a certain point. And I really believe that's where somatics can really pick up, kind of where the talk therapy ends. Somatics is where it picks up, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. There's a whole conversation we could have about pre-verbal stuff, which is a particular interest of mine, but... Well, let's have that conversation another time.
Yeah, we'll do it another time. Well, in the meantime, where can our listeners find out more about you and your work? How can they connect with you?
You can find out more about my private practice at passionatelife.org. You can find out about my podcast, Laid Open Podcast, at charnacassell.com. I also have a blog there. I have other, podcast guest appearances, blah, 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 on that website. And I also have an online course as well as a workbook at charnacassell.com.
Wonderful.
And you can follow me on Instagram and Facebook at laidopenpodcast.com.
Laid Open Podcast. And I'll drop those in the show notes on those links. Charna, thank you so much for being my guest today on the Sex Talk Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you for joining me for the Sex Talk Cafe. Please be sure to leave a 5-star review, subscribe, and share this podcast with your friends. And if you're ready to discover the 3 secrets to deepening connection, enhancing pleasure, and expanding your orgasmic potential, then be sure to grab your copy of the Pleasure Keys ebook at pleasurekeys.com. To learn more about my private coaching, couples retreats, and other offerings, be sure to connect with me at pathwaytopleasure.com or find me on social media at Susan Morgan Taylor. Thank you again so much for joining me today for the Sex Talk Cafe.